This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, John Decker of Merced, California, spent 28 years in the Air Force. He flew a whole lot of planes, many you've never even heard of. And in addition to World War II, he carried out some very interesting roles in the war that we always seem to forget about, the Cold War. The first major crisis of the Cold War, of course, came in 1948 with the Soviet blockade of Berlin. And for close to a year, American planes were dropping what added up to over 4,700 tons of supplies to keep West Berlin free. Later, Mr. Decker commanded a squadron of KC-135s, those giant jets that flew around the world refueling B-52 bombers. I'm curious, though, having seen the laundry list of military aircraft that you've actually flown in your long career, which one did you like the most? What was your favorite airplane?
The last one I flew was KC-135, and that is a dream airplane. The 135, I think, was my favorite. I've been very many places with it, long range and everything else, although the KC-97 for a while was my best one, too, because I flew around the world and that. I got up to Greenland. And we were stationed up there by 15th Air Force, just alert during the Cold War. But we didn't have any job, so we just took 20 airplanes, an entire squadron, both flying and ground, and flew over both North Poles, the geographical one and the magnetic one. And up in that area, you don't have too many navigational aids. So it was kind of check, but we all had our navigators and everything else, and we flew around both of them. And it's an achievement I don't think anybody else in the Air Force has ever made with everybody in the outfit. We used to have about 150 people, and we loaded them aboard 20 airplanes. And in line, we went across North Pole first, the geographical one, and then to the magnetic pole, and landed back in Greenland. And that was all we had to do. We didn't have any alerts or flying B-47s or anything else, so we had to make up our own training program.
Yeah, I don't think very many people can claim that distinction. I want to talk to you more about that, but let me take you back in time, because I know you lived through the Cold War and through the Vietnam era and all that other stuff. But World War II was so consuming worldwide. The world really was at a crisis point and a tipping point. And without what America and its allies did, we'd be living in a much different world. So for you, when that war came to an end, what was the significance of that for you? Do you remember how that felt to find out, you know what, this is finally over? Because you're a pretty young guy and had your whole life in front of you.
People are celebrating the end of the war. Of course, we still had Japan to go, but when he ended the European portion of it, I was just as happy as everybody else was, and feel that, well, now we go back to being survivors, not heroes. I really liked the Air Force by then, because got used to it, although it did have some of its drawbacks. But no, at the end of the war, I was just happy as anybody else. Actually, they were going to tell me I was going to go to Japan, and I said, I just came back from Northwest Africa. They said, well, we have to send somebody out, but okay, but the next one you have to go. So next one came was Germany after the occupation, and well, there it was. We went, and I had to wait for my wife to come over and join me with two children. But we enjoyed it and made friends over there, both German and other military friends.
Well, and you talked about how consuming that duty was, and how when they asked you to have that inspection team again, you turned it down because of that. But in that time, these are the years right after World War II, to be in Germany, I bet that gave you an interesting perspective on how Germany recovered after the war, and maybe even the character of the people there. Do you have any stories along those lines?
Well, when I first got to Germany on the occupation, I was at a place called Fürstenfeldbruck, and they had an orientation down there that told me that the Germans were warlike people, and that I was an occupier. I would do no fraternization or anything else. That was what I got there. A year later, we were then told we were trying to teach them democracy, and that we're supposed to be friends with them and everything else. So it changed in 1 year from you're an occupier to now you're a friendly type. And so it was a little hard to get over that. But like I ran into one that worked in an office in our headquarters, a German woman. They had their first votes while we were there. And she came in the office the next day and said, I'm not going to vote anymore. I said, why? She said, well, the person I voted for didn't make it. So it's a learning factor that they ain't going to make some of them.
Yeah. They hadn't been exposed to that for a while. The Berlin Airlift, what was your role and what do you remember about that and how severe that situation was?
Well, at that time I was in the Inspector General's office. I was executive officer. And we had a new commanding general, General LeMay. He had certain ideas how to thing. And when he finally decided on the airlift, he put a directive down to the staff officers. We would fly two missions a week when it first started out because they didn't have enough pilots or enough airplanes. And we'd take one flight on Saturday, and on Sunday we'd come back, and then Sunday we'd go again. So guess what? I reported down to ops. They said, okay, we flight take Saturday, and you're taking off at night. And I took off. And what it was set up at Wiesbaden. They had a circular thing around one runway, and they lined all the C-47s up, loaded them to the hilt, and the first airplane would get out in the runway, check his engines, and he'd be called Willie 1. The next one come out, he'd be Willie 2. And it was night, raining, and we climbed to 5,000 feet, take off a certain thing, make a turn at another place, and go toward Berlin and land. And so I was Willie 5, and I took off, and it was pitch dark and raining, climbed my 5,000 feet, and just merely, because we were loaded, and started toward Berlin. And I was about 50 miles from Berlin, and I'm Willie 5, and I heard Willie 6 calling in for landing instructions. That means he's passed me in the night someplace. And then as I got to Berlin, I was making my circle around, go line up with the runway, and I saw a flash behind me. So I looked back, and there was a C-47 on the ground that had spun in, manned by some lieutenant, which I don't know whether he was qualified or not, but he lost control of his airplane, and it was the first casualty, and I don't think he had too many others after that, but we did lose one at that night, my first flight. And then, of course, they came over with the C-54s and more pilots, so we went back to doing staff duty.
I know you've talked about how in the military you're just following orders and you're doing what they tell you to do. But knowing what the mission was in this instance and the lives that were depending on it, did that have any kind of impact on you or color your approach to those duties?
Oh, yes. In fact, we had some stories about some pilots who were set up to drop candy when they went by and everything else. Everybody thought that was a good idea, and we made friends with Germans in the airport and everything else, and it was a good friendly attitude on our part and their part. Yes, we enjoyed that.
I know I'm condensing a long career into a short interview here, and you told me what your favorite airplane was, the KC-135, and I don't know how many people would say that, because that's a plane that I think is an afterthought in a lot of people's minds. People gravitate toward the fighters and the bombers. They don't think about the flying gas tank that keeps the rest of them in the air. How much pride did you take in that role, not just the plane you flew yourself, but all the guys under your leadership that were flying KC-135s?
Well, we had a very good camaraderie about 135. We had regular parties and everything else, and everybody seemed to get along real fine. Of course, the thing about a castle, we were the SACs, what we call finest, because every one of my pilots, boom operators and navigators, were instructor pilots. And they were selected from their home, wherever it was, as being one of the top men in the unit. So I had a group of people that you just couldn't find in one squadron. I mean, all of them that way, they were very enjoyable to meet, party with, fly with.
And I don't want to exaggerate anything, but I think about the KC-135 and its significance. You know, the Cold War is often forgotten, and people don't realize how close we came to mutually assured destruction during those times. Is that the legacy for you of the KC-135, that without that plane, its capacity and its the range that it added for our bombers, that maybe something different would have unfolded during the Cold War? Is that an exaggeration?
No, I think that as far as I was concerned, Strategic Air Command was the only one in the service that I knew that had a mission, and that was to prevent a nuclear war. And we do that by having people on a ready to go, and refueled so they could go any place in the world and strike a target. So I felt real confident that SAC was doing its job as we went along.
And it wasn't just the B-52s on their own couldn't have achieved that great a deterrent, right?
Well, and joking about it, we kept telling them, you can't get there and back without us. However, and I guess it's not classified now, but in some of our E-War plans, we had to give the bomber going all the fuel he needed. Even it included that we had to give up what we had and crash land. But that was no concern. We figured we'd still hack it.
So to be clear, you're saying if our leadership greenlighted a nuclear attack on the Soviet Union or a mission of that nature, that the gas was required, the fuel was required for the B-52, you guys would sacrifice yourselves?
Well, we didn't expect, in fact, we have to crash land or something like that because we had given all the fuel they needed. Not a question of how much we had. It was all the fuel they needed, and we were just on our own.
How close do you think we came?
Well, of course, there's a lot of TV broadcasting and stories about how close we came and everything else, and I really couldn't judge it, but we didn't get that far, so it must have been good.
Well, is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you think is important for us to understand? And is there something that, as you look back on this long career, that you're the most proud of?
No, I think that for the young person that needs a career, that the services would be ideal as long as they could understand what their requirement would be. Like, I have a son. He went to Vietnam, and now he's back as a wounded or disabled Vietnam with a pension. But he's got a certain attitude. It's about the same as mine. He did what he's had to do, and that was it.
Well, I know you don't think that makes you a hero, but we do. And as for those who you would call the heroes, the 405,000 Americans who didn't come home from the war in World War II, how often do you think about them, and what do you think we should know today about the price that was paid for our freedom?
Well, being 93 going on 94, I keep losing more friends. About every 3 months, I go to a funeral, and it makes me very sad that I'm losing all these friends. And they were good friends, too. But that's the way life is.
How do you feel about Castle Air Museum?
Well, my observation of the museum here is that I know some of the people. They're all very dedicated, and they're all trying to keep it up, enlarge it, improve it, and I think they should be given all the help you can give from the local, both in donations and attendance to the various events they have. I think it's a great idea to look at your heritage sitting out here in their field and also inside the buildings. So I'm all in favor of the museum.
And do I have to ask you what your favorite aircraft on display is here?
135.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say that.
I like the B-47 too. That was never been in combat, but it was a good airplane too.
The other thing I promised I would ask you, and I've got to get just for my own good, if not for everybody else, because I would love to be able to say someday that my wife and I have been married for 72 years. What's your secret to making it work for that long?
I keep telling people the first 60 years are the hardest. From then it's downhill.
The first 60, did you say?
60 is the hardest. After that it's downhill. However, it is having a person you get along with and helps you. In fact, she's the one that kept me going a lot of times in the service when I was a little down. And between the two of us, we raised 4 children, and that's it.
All right, let's see if their stories match up here. Ruth, you still like each other after 72 years?
Oh, yes. Of course we still like each other. We still love each other. We get along well together. We have the same interests. He looks after me completely nowadays because I'm blind. But he's taken over.
Are you pretty proud of him and his service?
Oh, yes, very much so. We get along, we have friends, and we do things together. I can't think of any other thing else that you go with a marriage that long. Didn't plan on it, but I didn't plan on this age either, so.
Well, I'm glad it worked out that way, and I'm glad I had the privilege of meeting you both today and hearing some of your stories. I just want to say, Mr. Decker, thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us some of that. Is there anything else that you wanted to say?
No. I want to wish everybody the best of everything. And I'm not quite sure whether I wish everybody lived at 94, but give it a go.
Amen. Why not? John Decker, our guest today. I know there are so many more stories he could have told about all the different airplanes he flew. Well, maybe you'll catch him at Castle Air Museum in Atwater, and you can get a few stories out of him. Maybe you want to visit for the museum's Strawberry Waffle Brunch on April 27th or the Open Cockpit Day, May 25th. You can find info on those events and all the aircraft on display, including Air Force One, which is there now. You can find that all at the museum's newly redesigned website, castleairmuseum.org. It really looks good, castleairmuseum.org. We're out of time on this edition of Hometown Heroes, but join me again next time so we can be reminded together again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.